Howdy, partners, and welcome to Rage of Free Nintender.
Don't do that.
Is that because I use howdy in the Skype?
No. Okay. I say howdy all the time. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, we have John Lindemann.
I have no apologies for Iwata apologists.
And James Jones.
This is not the time to start this shit. We just got started.
And Guillaume Bayette.
I'm all hopped up on Red Bull and chocolate-covered coffee beans. Let's do this.
Again? You might have a problem.
I could use some of that right now. Yeah. I have to confess, I've come down with a bit of a cold this week, so I may not have my usual energy level, and a lot of our listeners will probably be relieved to hear that. I know James is relieved. All right, guys. So we're going to have a pretty normal show. We're going to do new business. We got some excellent games lined up. And in the second half, we've got a lot of excellent listener mail. And make sure you listen all the way to the end because we've got a special retroactive announcement at the end of the episode.
It's about games. We're going to play games this time.
Yeah, we're going to play games and talk about them. Hmm. Very special.
It is for John. Boom!
So we're going to kick off with new business, and Guillaume is first.
Yes, I'm going to kick it off with old new business. I finished LEGO City Undercover.
It's not that old, man.
Well, yeah, sure. But, I mean, in internet time, it's like ages.
It's a revisit to the LEGO City.
Yes. And dare I say, best game ever?
No, I don't.
You
dare not.
But it is.
You better fucking not.
But, you know, like I was, I think last time I was a little bit more negative on a game than I wanted to come across. Because it really has been an enjoyable ride, for sure. And, you know, while the game is not two players, is not a co-op game, unlike the other LEGO games, you know, my girlfriend really likes those games, and I've been watching her play through her file, and I've been enjoying the cutscenes and the voice acting and the jokes and all the crazy stuff that happens in the game, just like watching it again. And as she was playing, she was saying, like, wow, this is the best game I've ever played. And I kind of understand where she comes from. She hasn't played as many games as I have, but or as any of us have, but still, you know, like I can understand coming out of that game feeling like, you know, like, wow, how do you top that?
So you both like it. I mean, that's a very good endorsement.
Yeah, definitely. So it's hard to talk about the game without spoiling anything. I feel like just mentioning the costumes that have not been part of like the marketing.
Do it. Do it.
Well, I do want to say though, like just to entice people to give it a shot, that one of the best costumes, and I would not have expected this, but one of the best costumes is the farmer costume. Because when you're a farmer, apparently you have at all times on your person a chicken that you can use as a gun. I let you imagine, picture what it's like.
So I assume you mean anally. Anally used as a gun. Yes.
So Banjo-Kazooie did that a long time ago. But yeah, okay.
And there's something else you can do with it that you can do in another game, old school game. You can just hang from its feet and just glide gracefully.
Oh, thank God. I wasn't sure where you were going with that.
Good Lord. It's a family game. It's for kids. But yeah, like just like right out of like Ocarina of Time or various other Zelda games, you can just like grab the chicken's feet and just glide gracefully through the air.
So the different costumes give you different abilities, just like playing as different characters in other LEGO games.
Yeah, basically how the game's structure is that you start out as a cop, and then of course you have to go undercover. So you gain the ability to become like a criminal and to just, you know, wrench open some doors or whatever. But then, you know, you have to go deeper and deeper, and eventually you go through, you know, not the whole cast of village people, but close. And You go like the different costumes that you've done. Yes, give you special abilities. The game does not have a whole lot of combat, but what it has instead is just a whole lot of stuff to do and stuff to find. And you know, I'm fine with that. Like as I said last time I spoke about that game, I do like open world games, but you know, eventually they kind of devolve into collectathons and several of those games when they're just a little bit cinematically inclined, like they're trying to tell a story and they want you to go through, get through the game and see the ending and all they had planned for you, just like Assassin's Creed 2, well, they kind of nerf the combat, or, you know, they make the enemies just so easy that they can't possibly hurt you. And, you know, like that annoyed me in Assassin's Creed 2 because you're playing an assassin. You know, and you would think that the forces of the law would present some challenge, but in Lego City, you're a cop, so cops don't touch you most of the time. And you know, like the fact that the combat is easy is just not preventing me from enjoying it when all the shit that I have to do is just so crazy and so much fun.
Well, it's a very lighthearted game, right?
Yeah, and yeah. It will have you do stuff that are both, you know, completely insane and just a lot of fun, and will make you overlook a lot of the flaws that you might find in the game. For instance, as I said, the farmer, not only does he carry a chicken at all times on him, but also there has been a bunch of mountain pigs that have escaped from their pens. And that have
the
like,
worst kind of pig.
I know. And they can just like climb up walls and just, you'll find them on high rises all over the city. And what you have to do is climb up, fetch them, mount them, and just ride them towards the nearest pig cannon where you'll be able to launch them back to their pen on the farm. I am willing to overlook a lot of flaws when, you know, gameplay consists of shooting pigs out of cannons. That's the best way I can put it.
it seems to be a perfect fit for your sense of humor, Guillaume.
Yeah.
I don't think I would appreciate it quite the same way that you do, but you make it
but
enticing.
It works. Yeah, it works so well though. Like I would try to find at least like a YouTube video of that happening, because the music and, you know, like the joie de vivre of your farmer.
The joie de vivre of pig cannons.
Yeah, of your farmer guy, or just like, just really sell it, you know, like they're just like, they come together so well, and it makes it for a really special experience. Anyway, like it's awesome. it's not just like the different tasks that you have to do that are really good. Like I you know, I was complaining that perhaps like the story or the dialogue was not as funny as I wished it were. But in the end, you know what? Like the different characters grew on me, and I really came to enjoy even like the terrible, terrible puns that they throw at you. Like you end up being like, yeah. Like they're probably aware that the puns are terrible, but you know, it's like you laugh with them and not at them, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And it's still kind of a little bit jarring though, that the fact that it seems that the writers of this game grew up with the exact same references that I did, because then you just end up spotting like, oh yeah, this is a joke that they stole from an old episode of The Simpsons. Or this is a joke, like this quote is straight out of Galaxy Quest of all places. You know, like yeah. I can just like spot the different references like that, and it's
well, what's know, funny so is weird. You have to wonder if kids that are playing it right now will come back to the game 10, 15 years from now when they've kind of seen those movies or whatever and actually realize it.
Will kids today go back and watch Galaxy Quest?
No, the better question is, will kids today go back and play Lego City Undercover? And the answer is a definitive no.
I don't know. I mean, if you played that game as a kid and really, really liked it, you know.
You're also a child right now. In the future, though, you'll have you'll have all your Oculus Rift stuff, and you'll be fine, because you won't want to Lego City Undercover anymore.
Google Glass will play the game for you.
Also, if this game catches on, there will have been like 48 Lego City Undercovers 10 years from now, so it's fine.
Anyway, I just, you know, I've played the game for about 30 hours, and I'm through like 70% of all the collectibles or whatever. I've put it aside for now, but I do plan to come back to it when, you know, I'm just in the mood after a crappy day for just like messing around in a very non-threatening, very funny game. I do plan to come back and try to eventually finish it 100%, but doing it all in one go is a little bit, you know, I don't think it would be very fun right now. But yeah, like it's you know, it's a very fun game. And I guess I don't want to spoil this, so I'm going to actually edit this out, and that's why you have to play Lego City.
Good to know. Cool, man. I thought the game was really impressive back at E3 last year. I thought it was pretty fun. It was hard. The driving was really bad.
You get used to it.
Yeah, I was impressed with the graphics, and I thought the pace of it was nice, and it was kind of fun to play an open world game, you know, like this open city that you can explore, but the sun's always shining and it has this kind of bright, colorful look to it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of open world games are much more, you know, it's usually nighttime or it's kind of cloudy and they want to make it look more realistic. And so they do a lot of things with the lighting to make it look dirtier, you know?
Yeah.
And I thought there was something quite charming about the way Lego City portrays that city as being so clean and very, very inviting, you know?
Yeah, in my open worlds, I tend to, like, you know, I think my favorite one is probably Bully, you know, just because of, yeah, I tend to veer towards the funnier ones rather than the, I don't know, the GTAs of the world, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. And GTA is funny sometimes.
Yeah, well, I've only played 4.
Less so lately.
I feel like its joke's kind of worth in. I mean,
yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to James, and James, why don't you tell us about your latest GameCube discovery?
Yeah, I'm just working my way through. I got to...
Working my way through the cube, babe. Sorry, please continue.
I don't even want to live anymore. I've lost the will to live. I'm just ready to go die now. Thank you, John. Thanks, I really appreciate that. That's really what I needed in my life.
I'm so self-indulgent, I swear.
Yep. Anyway... I've pulled off the top of the list now, Battalion Wars, the GameCube one, so the one we do have a review for on the site.
Hey.
And I'm about 10 or so missions in. I've made some progress with it, you know, a handful of hours. I've already crossed the hour threshold, so I'm probably gonna ride this one out to the end. But my first thoughts on it are, I came into this with absolutely no experience with the franchise and only kind of really top level understanding of what I was getting into. So basically what the game is.
You've played Advance Wars, right?
I have, but this is quite a bit different than Advance Wars.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a spin-off.
It's a spin-off. It is a spin-off that takes the concept very far. It's not really a strategy game, although there's some tactic stuff involved in it. Mm-hmm. It's you control a character from the Advance Wars. I don't mean like the crazy flamboyant characters. I mean, one of the grunts on the ground. And you lead some number of units of similar origin around the battlefield to engage enemies, much like you would if you were a grunt on Advance Wars and someone were pointing you where to go. It's very much like Advance Wars from the perspective of the foot soldiers, except you're also making decisions yourself. It's kind of a weird thing to wrap your head around. And it's like strategy elements in a third-person shooter.
So did you ever play Battlezone for PC back circa 1998?
I don't think so.
It was very similar. It was like, you'd be on the moon or on the surface of Mars, and you had this... It was a real-time strategy, basically, and you had all these different tanks and turrets you could set up, and you were gathering resources... And yet you were commanding all of this from one of the units on the ground, and you could actually kind of warp. It wasn't as easy as in Battalion Wars, I think, but you could warp from one unit to another. So you could get involved directly in the combat while also issuing menu commands to tell your other people where to go and what to build. It was a lot to juggle, but it was a really cool concept, and that Battalion Wars always reminded me of that from when I first saw it.
Yeah, so in this game, you don't really have the ability to do menu commands. I mean, you really have to be with the unit in question to give them orders. And you can still juggle your orders by picking various subdivisions of the forces that comprise your battalion and sort of giving them different directives, but it's really hard to kind of manage what's going on at a macro level. You really have to stay pretty tightly embedded with the units that are doing stuff. Otherwise, they're going to get their shit wrecked, primarily. So, you know, there's a bit of the paper, rock, scissors, Pokemon type thing going on here, where, just like in the Advanced Wars games, you know, foot soldiers are really shitty against tanks, but they're really good against, you know, units that use bazookas. Bazookas are really awesome against tanks, but really shitty against soldiers. Everybody kind of sucks against aircraft, unless they're anti-air personnel, stuff like that. So, I'm only about 10 missions in, so I've only got about 7 or so unit types to play with. And you get a lot of these little mission objectives that ultimately end with you completing the base mission, which is usually destroy this thing. It's been fun. It's kind of frustrating sometimes when you're trying to get your forces to sort of marshal in one place while you're leading force another set of forces to deal with something like you're trying to wipe out force things that'll threaten your tanks so you can
Does
move your
tanks
up.
Does it feel like it would be easier if you could use the Wii remote pointer?
Possibly.
Mm-hmm.
We'll never know, will we? But
We could, but we don't.
Well, I've actually played the Wii version, but very little and a long time ago, so I don't remember if these things are easy to pull off.
Yeah,
it was a pretty early Wii game.
It was,
and this
a
was
very
a
early
late
game.
GameCube game. So it felt like Battalion Wars 2 came out really close after the first
one. I want to say it's 2006 is what I saw on the splash screen. So I mean that would be really close because I think Battalion Wars Wii was out by 2008. Yeah, but a lot of the difficulty I have is just trying to manage. I mean, you could bring everybody up together and then just order the forces that are advantageous in this encounter to attack, but you still, you know, leave stuff exposed versus leaving everybody who's weak sort of at a holding pen and then coming back to get them when it's safe for them to advance.
Mm.
So there's some tactics there, knowing what units to bring with you and how to engage the enemy, and there's some action there in that you control a character directly. It's just the marriage of the two sometimes makes for a little bit of awkwardness. I will say that the voice acting is horrendously bad. I mean, I don't even understand. I mean, this is only like 7 years ago. This voice acting is atrocious. And some of the characters, you're kind of like, they got away with this 7 years ago, really? Like, what is it? Brigadier Betty. Who is possibly the worst character in the history of video games. I mean...
She's got tough competition.
She's pretty terrible.
Yeah.
So she's an airhead commander who never stops talking. It talks like this! All the time. She's a brigadier in the fucking army. Get it together.
By the way, Battalion Wars 2 is 2007.
But, yeah, so there's some interesting strategy decisions you can make, and you get to decide how you want to advance your forces around. You know, you can try to bypass whole groups of enemies. You can have as much in-depth action and thought as you want with the game, but you really need to just understand that, you know, the Pokemon type system, and you pretty much have the game beat. It's, you know, it's not very hard. I've not really struggled with anything except for when I leave forces somewhere safe and then a helicopter shows up and they make no active effort to defend themselves. It's like, oh, we're getting shot. This sucks. So it would be nice if the game gave you some kind of it gives you a small alert, but if it really was like, hey, dude, your shit's getting effed up. You should probably go deal with this. It'd probably be a little bit more helpful. But yeah, I mean, I'm enjoying it enough that I'll pull all the way through it. I wish I could do more at the beginning, but that's kind of the way all these games are, where you're like, all right, you get to deal with regular troops. Now you get a car. Now you get two cars. Like, just please. I want a helicopter. I'm watching helicopters fly overhead. I want that. I don't want to be down here anymore. I want to be up there. And you're like, no, that's not happening anytime soon. Okay, fine game. I'll deal with that.
That is going to be cool, though, once you can.
I'm sure it will be, but it's the problem with that in games is always they give it to you so late. That it's you don't get to use it that much.
Yeah,
it's sort of the trade off. You're like, okay, you're ready for this. Also, there's only 3 levels left. Like, well, great. I don't get to enjoy it. I don't get to enjoy the best part of the game. Sucks.
Plus, this game has no multiplayer, unlike the Wii version.
It does not. No. So it is a. Once you've completed the single player campaign, really all there is to do is to go back to try to improve your score, which seems totally arbitrary. I mean, the percentages are speed, power, and there's one other thing that factors into it. I can't remember. Technique. What are power and technique? I don't know.
So do you like unlock S ranks, and does that unlock anything at all?
Not that I've seen. I've got a couple S ranks. It doesn't seem to do anything. It's just you have an S rank now.
Oh.
But since I don't know what power and technique are, I guess it really doesn't make much of a difference because I'm not going to go back to find out.
Well, do you have a manual or do you have...
I do actually have the manual, but I'm not going to be bothered to read that shit. Come on.
Well, in the regular Advance War series, I think power has you... Well, this is not going to help you. Power Good. Is you kill a maximum amount, a number of units in one turn. So,
oh,
so,
well, that's it.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just need to kill as many units as I can in one turn,
yeah,
which the game doesn't have.
Just keep pressing start, pause the game. And
it's a turn. It just counts as a turn.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, I don't know. It's fun, but it's definitely got some flaws. I have noticed in this little trip through GameCube history, we really sucked at making start menus in games in 2003 to 2006. I mean, there are some really bad start screens that like menus are hidden under other menus. We're like, we're not gonna get to this, or the restart in advance or in Battalion Wars. If you hit start, restart isn't one of the first options you get. You have to page three times to get to restart mission.
That's still a problem today in some games.
Yeah, but it's not usually that bad. Like I was like, wait, there's no restart in this stupid game? I didn't find it until later. I was like, oh my god. And there's no way to skip videos. It's like, oh god.
Oh, that's brutal. That's a killer.
And they're long. They're so long.
And they're probably not the highest of, you know.
No, they're not good. They're not good videos.
I could envision the videos in Battalion Wars being kind of like the war level from Conker's Bad Fur Day, but without the satire.
Without the clever
and more
writing.
Plasticky.
Well, I'm pretty sure the satire would be there. No, because like it is kind of a cartoon world. They're in Advance Wars.
Yeah,
there's not that much satire in Advance Wars though.
No, because they're because you're superior officer is flirting with the enemy superior officer like the whole battle, like we should hang out sometime. I'm like, fuck you, I'm killing his shit. It's like, this isn't the time for you guys to be hooking up.
All right, it's not satire, but it's not serious either.
No,
war is fun.
That's it is kind of this weird war is fun message going on. It's like,
well, that would be consistent with the original franchise.
It's like, hey, after the battle, we should go get a drink. I'm like, the fuck? I'll have killed like 80 of his people after the battle. You really want to go hang out?
Well, you would need a drink.
I would. He wasn't doing anything. He was sitting on his ass back at the base talking really slowly to me about combat strategy in a game that has none of this. Oh. God.
So you're going to stick with it, though. Maybe you can give us an update.
Yeah,
on a future episode.
I'm enjoying it enough that I'll finish it off, especially because it's not very long.
Cool. All right, man. So we're going to move on to John, who is playing the ultimate version of a franchise that I have a special relationship with.
Yes. I have to invoke the spirit of one Greg Leahy here.
Oh, no.
Ultimate Ghosts and Goblins for PSP, which is a game that I wanted for a long time, but I never really got around to buying, even though I just saw it drop in price and drop in price. I never really wanted yet another PSP cartridge or UMD or whatever they were called.
on PSN, it's been affordable for a long time, though.
Yeah, but it became really affordable. It went on sale for a whole $5. So I was like, well, I can't turn that down. So I picked it up, and I have to say, I like it a lot, but I hate it a lot as well. But
that's what the designers are going for.
That's much like Super Ghouls and Ghosts.
Mission accomplished.
Yes, mission accomplished, absolutely, Guillaume. Yeah, it's hard. And I mean, they've kind of fleshed it out to a large degree, because Super Ghouls and Ghosts is very simple. I mean, you can't really do anything else but, throw your lance or whatever and jump around. There's really nothing else you can do. But in the ultimate version, you can cling on to a ledge if so you have kind of a little bit of a safety net there if you happen to get knocked off of something and you're near a ledge, you'll kind of grab onto it. So that helps.
Okay, I'm listening.
That helps. But don't get your hopes up, Johnny. you have the same mechanic where if you get hit once, you lose some. You lose your armor, and you can build up to different degrees of armor. Like you can get silver armor, and then you can get gold armor, and then you can get red armor, and you can have that knocked down, and then eventually you lose your clothes, and then you die. So there's still that element still in play. So you have kind of a little bit of health, sort of. You start off with a lot more lives. I think you start off with 5 lives, and I think you have unlimited continues. However, they certainly took the opportunity in a game that is supposedly, you would think that all that makes the game easier, but it really doesn't, because they absolutely pile on the enemies that attack you at once. So at any given time, in any given, you know, area of the game, you'll be, you know, walking along and you'll have spikes coming up from the ground, a monster appearing beside you, a monster running, you know, a monster flying at you from above. And then on top of that, there's another monster over here who isn't flying at you, but he's shooting at you. And then on top of that, there'll be like a poison arrow coming across. And so pretty much anytime you die, you're getting attacked by about 4 or 5 angles at once.
A day in the life of Arthur.
Yeah. So what I've had happen is, you know, I'll make some miraculous escape from, you know, some enemy, only to, you know, jump to a certain spot and just get killed by something else where I had absolutely no shot. So I went from having pretty much no shot to, you know, being able to survive to having absolutely no shot. So, yeah. So
oh,
it's,
Capcom, you asshole.
Yeah. So it's, you know, you know, you can continue as much as you want, but pretty much the continues don't run out, but your patience does. So typically yep. that's what makes me put the game down. But I come back to it, though. I come back to it because I'm a sick bastard. So.
If you have infinite continues, can you make a game so hard no one can beat it?
I don't know. I mean, I'm about halfway through it right now. The good thing is they do use checkpoints. So when you restart, you don't start all the way back at the beginning of any level.
Even when you continue.
Oh, that's not right. You should have to go all the way back to the start.
Well, you shouldn't. Isn't James. There? I think that there is a kind of classic or hard mode where you don't get the checkpoints, right?
There probably is. I haven't gone there yet.
That's the Capcom I know and love.
You have to unlock it by beating the game twice on one credit.
No, the Capcom I know and love would make you unlock the easy mode by beating the game twice.
Yeah, there is a hard mode, but I didn't even consider it. I was like, let's just try and beat this bad boy on normal.
You coward!
And it's been challenging so far. But I mean, the game looks really good. You know, like Arthur himself is sort of 3D, and there's, you know, a little bit. It's kind of like 2.5D sort of thing. But yeah, it's difficult. It's difficult. And, you know, the cool thing is, though, you can save your game and load your game, so you don't have to start from the beginning, all the way from back at the beginning every time. So there's a lot of different hooks where it's technically, I guess, because of the certain ways that they let you attack the game, it's more forgiving, and I'm sure that didn't go down well with the purists out there. But for those of us that only have a certain amount of time to throw at the game, it's quite appreciated. But still, that game is hard as nails. and a couple of more wrinkles they throw in is you can shoot up, you can shoot down. There's like a scythe that you can throw, and you can grab items above you. Like you can, you know, you can. They'll have like hidden items that, you know, are off in the air. So you have to get a certain item, you know, get a certain thing to attack with, and you can grab it out of midair and bring it back to you. Let's see, a couple of other things. There, you can also you can find kind of hidden things and equip them. So they have sort of like some hidden areas that are gated by you having a certain item that you can get into. Like there's you can collect a series of staves, and each staff will allow you, kind of unlocks an area that you've already been in and lets you go back to it, so you can try it, go through it again. Don't know why you would ever want to do that, but
well, it's useful when you have to beat the game the second time.
Yeah.
You can use all those staves to access the levels.
I want to be so excited when John thinks he's halfway there, only to realize, no.
Yeah, I haven't really back investigated how badly it screws you at the end of the game, but
it makes him a cripple and takes you back to the start.
But yeah, I mean,
no more jumping.
Yeah, it's interesting because you can tell that they've sort of incorporated a few of the. It reminds me more of, like, you know, Castlevania 4. A little bit, you know, kind of they've added the elements that were added to Castlevania 4 for the Super Nintendo.
Oh, right. Like
some of those are
up and
yeah. Like I wish you could attack on diagonals, but you can't, which is a real pain in the ass. But they do have some things like homing missiles and stuff like that. That kind of you know, that you kind of have to rely on in certain areas just because you get attacked from all angles. So there's a lot of that. There's a lot of, oh, I got this and it sucks. You know, this knife is crappy because I can only, you know, fire straight ahead, and I have things coming at me all over the place. If I only had this scythe that I can throw or whatever, it would be much easier. So there's that kind of element of sort of, you know, picking what you use. But yeah, it's kind of like that. They've mixed it up a little bit and added a few wrinkles, so the gameplay isn't just straight ahead, you know, jump, fire, die. It's a little bit. But it's good. I mean, anybody that's a fan of getting their face beat in, I highly recommend it.
Count me in.
I like difficult platformers. Just, it's well documented, but I just can't stand the way... I don't like the way this game builds challenge. You know, I don't like enemies coming up out of the ground underneath me as I'm in the air.
Just have to know you need to jump at this point, because otherwise some dude's going to come up and grab you in the testicles, and you will not enjoy that.
They do a whole lot of things of putting an item that you need off in midair so that and these are items that you can't get any other way. Like, you have to jump, get them, and then jump back onto a platform. But the platform is moving, so you literally have to time it exactly so that you can jump far enough over to get it and then jump back onto the platform before it moves away from you. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff like that where I just look at stuff and I'm just like, I have no idea how anybody could ever get that.
Oh, it means you have to get it before it reaches the apex of its movement.
Exactly.
Too. So you have to jump. You can say if you miss the jump, you have to wait all the way.
Yeah, and if you screw it up, of course you die because there's never any floor underneath you. So
Capcom, you're so good at this.
It's ridiculous.
Like, you're so good at this.
Yeah.
All right. So that's Ultimate Ghosts and Goblins, a bastard of a game, I'm sure.
It is. It is.
So I'm next up, and I've been playing a game on Steam that is coming to Wii U later this year, I believe. It was recently announced that they were going to port it over, and probably to other consoles as well, I would assume. But it's called Guiana Sisters Twisted Dreams. And this is a European-developed platforming franchise that has only rarely come over to America and has rarely appeared on Nintendo systems. I think the only one before this, there was a DS game, although I'm not sure the DS Guiana Sisters ever came out in America.
No, it did release. Like, it was, I remember that it was reviewed in Nintendo Power, and then a year later, it actually came out in, like, Amazon, and only on Amazon.
The DS game did come out in North America, and I almost bought it because of this series' history. Hmm. So, it did. There was a Guiana Sisters that came out on... Oh, I guess they never did make the NES port. It came out on everything else in Europe.
It was first an Amiga game or something like that.
And then it was an Amstrad. Then there may have been an ST and a 64 and an MSX2. I think it came out on everything. I think they stuck to the small ones because they got the shit suit out of them.
Yeah, so famously, the original Guiana Sisters was a pretty shameless clone of Super Mario Brothers.
Guiana,
okay.
Yep.
So I've heard two different versions of the story, though. One is that they had approached Nintendo about making a port of Mario, and it wasn't Guiana yet.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
And Nintendo basically said, yeah, it's a good job, but no, we're not interested.
Yeah.
So then they went and they just said, fine, we'll just change the Goombas to owls and make Mario female and be done with it. And then Nintendo sued the living shit out of them.
Yeah, so, you know, that was a long time ago, and the series, although coming from pretty shady origins, was very well known in Europe and lived on, and they made more and more games, and they've continued to make games in the series. I don't know a whole lot about the DS one, but I think I recall hearing fairly good things about it.
It's supposed to be pretty decent.
Okay. Well, anyway, so I'm playing the brand new one. It just came out in late 2012 on PC. And it's not based on Mario at all. You know, this is kind of the end result of, you know, if Mario was cloned back in 1986 and then those two, you know, diverged from there and evolved on totally separate paths for the next 25 years, this is what you get at the end. It ends up actually being kind of, I mean, there are elements of Mario as much as there are in any 2D platformer, I guess, but it's certainly not shameless. It doesn't feel like a Mario clone in any way. And I would say also it mixes in some really cool elements of Sonic the Hedgehog, and the good ones, not the bad ones. So it has sections that are actually very fast, but they don't ask you to do any kind of really intricate platforming during those sections. It's more of kind of a show-off thing. And the overall pace of the game is somewhere in between Mario and Sonic. So it is definitely faster than a Mario game. But the kinds of platforming you're doing, I would say, are much more like Mario level design than they are like Sonic level design. And the premise of this game is that you're playing these two different sisters, and they seem to inhabit the same body, so it's almost like Trine, I guess, a little bit. But as you play through the game, you switch between them anytime you want. So you can either use a shoulder button to do that, or you can use one of their special moves. So each sister has a special move that only she can do. And if you're the other sister and you hit the button that's dedicated to the first one's special move, it'll do the move and transform you at the same time. So you can switch without doing a move, or you can use the special moves, and that will also switch you. So it's a little confusing at first, but you get the hang of it pretty fast, I think. And the cool thing is, as you play through, I mean, when you switch characters, it does a lot of the things you would expect. So certain gems that were kind of shadowed before will now come to the forefront, and now you can collect them. Certain platforms that were kind of, you know, you can see them, but they're not solid. Now they become solid. Other ones go away. And so you have to time, you have to switch in midair. You've seen this in other games, right?
Yeah, it's just like Fractured Soul.
Yeah, Fractured Soul, or the, what was the,
Outland?
Outland, thank you. Outland. Yeah, it's a terrible name for a 2D platformer. But anyway, yeah, Outland is a really cool game, and this is similar to that in a lot of ways. It did a lot of the same things. But the really cool thing about Gianna Sisters is that every time you switch, and I mean you switch constantly, like every second, you know, you're switching just all the time because the game is challenging and the level designs and the enemy placements are pretty intricate, even early in the game. And so they demand a lot of you. But every single time you switch, two really interesting things happen with the presentation. So first off, the music changes. So the melody, the core of the song is the same for both sisters. And so it's never interrupted, but the instrumentation and the kind of tone of the song is distinct for each sister. So every time you switch, one of them, the redheaded sister, who has this cool, like, fireball move that kind of shoots you. It's like a boost, you know. You can dash any direction you want to. You can use it in midair. It's a great attack. Her music tends to be more kind of rock-based, and so there's a lot of electric guitar in the song whenever you're using her. And then when you switch to the other one, she has the yellow-haired sister has a like a twisty spin jump that lets you float down slowly and have a lot of control on your way down. And whenever you switch to her, the music takes on kind of a more minor quality, and the electric guitar is usually replaced with piano. And so it has a kind of a more morose kind of a feel to it. And the graphics change in the same way. So when you're with the red-haired girl with the rock and roll soundtrack, the world is very kind of green and lush and vibrant. And then when you switch to the yellow-haired girl, the world gets a little bit darker and kind of more sickly looking, and a lot of the plants wither away, and some of the plants turn into like thorny vines. And all this stuff, the graphical stuff happens, it's like a morphing effect. So every time you switch, all these different elements that are in both the foreground and in the background of this 2D platformer, they all kind of animate and transform, and you actually see it happening. And it's a really, really cool effect, and it all happens pretty quickly, but you can definitely see all the kind of in-between stages of that transition. And then it happens every single time you switch, so it's just nonstop. So usually the level geometry doesn't change very much, but the look of the level changes completely.
Is there like a pause, or is it just like continuous?
No, there's no pause. It's very fluid. The whole game is very fast-paced and has a, you know, really nice flow to it. So there's no pause at all. And that's what's so cool about it. You know, like, you can just sit there and do it over and over and just watch this world transform back and forth. It's such a cool effect. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like that before. So the game is just very visually impressive. The music is really great, like I said, and it's just a cool concept for a soundtrack, in that every song in the game has two different versions and it's constantly flipping back and forth. And even as it does that, it's not jarring. You know, it's like a nice smooth transition. You notice it, but it just kind of sounds natural. It just sounds like almost like the song could be written to do that back and forth. And like I said, the level designs are really clever. The game is challenging. I wouldn't say overly difficult. The first boss gave me a lot of trouble. I had to go on YouTube and kind of get an idea for for the best way to dodge one of its moves, because it was, I was having a really hard time with it. But overall, I would say the game, it ramps up very quickly, and it kind of puts you in some really interesting, cool levels right off the bat, even in the first world. And I just made it to the second world, and it's just the same, you know. So they ask you to mix and match these abilities of the two different sisters all the time in really interesting ways. And they add, you know, enemy layouts and all kinds of different contraptions in the level that activate as you switch back and forth. And they make you do all this stuff all the time. And I'm enjoying it a hell of a lot. And I think, you know, if you're a fan of 2D platformers, which most people are, seems like, this is definitely a game to look out for. It was $15 on Steam. I would assume it's going to be a pretty similar price on Wii U. And I don't really know if they're adding any special features or not. I don't think we know very much about the Wii U version yet. It was just announced like a month ago, probably. But I would definitely recommend that you look forward to it.
Well, I will.
Yeah, you're going to love it, Guillaume. So we've got a little bit of time left in new business. Why don't we go back to Guillaume and let him talk about a game that he's been wanting to talk about for a long time.
Kind of. I don't know. Game that I bought at launch, and I guess it would have been relevant if I had talked about it at launch. My warning comes a little late now, but let me just tell you, if you're attracted to the game because of the digitized graphics and you think it looks like wacky Japanese fun, $8 is a lot to pay.
For
Tokyo Crash Mobs. Yeah, this game came out a while ago on the eShop, and if you don't know what it is, it's basically Puzzloop or Zuma.
Magnetica, I think.
Magnetica as well.
The other one.
Except instead of shooting marbles, colored marbles at other marbles to make them disappear, you're a digitized woman just throwing other digitized people. That's hard to say. Digitized people.
Yeah.
Just like waiting in line in front of you to make them disappear so that you can go, like, I don't know, eat at the buffet or something. They call them scenesters. So you're throwing scenesters at each other.
So it's Portland is what you're telling me. Boom.
Well, except that they're all Akihabara. Very clearly. Yeah, they're all very clearly Japanese. I bought this game partly because of the wacky Japanese fun, but also partly out of guilt, because I have bought Zuma in the past, but I have never ever supported before now Mitchell, which is the company that basically came up with the design for this type of game.
Yeah, PopCap kind of stole the idea. They cloned it. They cloned the idea and didn't give any kind of credit.
Yeah.
Legally, I'm sure they couldn't.
Right.
But yeah, Zuma is hardly an original idea.
Right. So I patronized PopCap. I never patronized Mitchell. And I was like, well, I feel bad for, you know, just giving my money away to the more successful copycat and not giving the originator what they were due. So that's also partly why I, you know, bit the bullet and paid $8.
I always find it's best to buy my games out of guilt.
Okay, it was three things. I do like Zuma. And, you know, it was partly a little bit of a guilt. And also, I do like Japanese wacky, crazy crap. That was a little bit redundant.
Yeah, everything from Japan is crazy crap. There you go.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I would say, like, if you saw videos of the game and, you know, of its various cutscenes and you're just like, oh, wow, that is confusing as hell and looks funny, you've seen the best part of the game. And they're just as confusing when you see them in context. Basically, the weird story is that you've got Grace, who can throw people over her head. So she can throw people over lines, which is kind of a different twist on the Zuma gameplay. And you've got Savannah, who bowls people like bowling balls. But yeah, so, you know, like, it's the same gameplay with a few twists, except that it's probably the worst playing version of Puzzloop / Zuma that you could ever possibly buy, because the way you aim is by touching the screen with a stylus, the touch screen. But all the action is on the top screen, so you're not having like a direct input here. You're just
what a weird design decision.
Well, but if you touch the top screen, you'd be covering up the action.
You'd know where you were aiming.
Well, yeah. Also, it's not a touchscreen.
Yeah, but I mean, if you touch the screen, that yeah, I mean, there's sort of a problem. Really, they should just have it on both screens so you can touch one without having to worry too much about covering
and
up the other.
They kind of did that, but they really want you to look at the digitized graphics in 3D. So what they did was kind of made a compromise, and you've got the outline of basically the line that these scene stirs form on the bottom screen, except that they're all like gray dots.
So they're in fact no way helpful to solving the...
Only slightly helpful, but you have to look at both screens at the same time. Basically, it's pretty challenging. But yeah, like because you know, like these digitized people are just like shifting around, like very badly animated. It's very hard to see exactly where you're aiming, even though like you can see the line of your throw before you throw someone. And also like to complicate matters even more, the lines keep shifting, you know, kind of like a snake, like it just like rides around. So yeah, I can't say that I recommend it, like especially not for $8. And you know what? Like there's not even online needle boards.
So look where your guilt got you, Guillaume.
I know.
Just think about that. It's something we can all learn from.
Screw Mitchell. Seriously.
He's trying to spread the lesson, in fairness.
The more you know.
Yeah. It's too bad. I like the videos I have seen from that game are hilarious, but I even when it first came out, I was kind of hearing that from other people too, is like these little videos that you can watch online are by far the best thing about this game.
So like yeah, you've got like Savannah, who seems to be like absolutely stressed out about maybe homework or something, but all she ends up doing is like draw spirals on paper. So she comes off as like the killer in Dark City. And and she daydreams that people are, you know, trying to push buttons that send her into space, into the cold blackness of space.
Good.
Yeah, and you've got Grace, who's just a glutton, apparently, and she wants to go to these new restaurants, but there's always big lines, so she just kills people.
Nice.
And that's the story. Also ninjas.
Also ninjas.
Yep.
All right, so before we wrap up, I want to spend just a couple minutes talking about one other game I have just started playing this week, which is Guacamelee. Now, James and I got to play a little bit of this in two-player mode at PAX East.
We did.
And despite the Metroidvania leanings, I kind of smelled James having fun playing this game.
Wow.
I'd rather not smell James having fun, for the record.
It was, you know, I didn't think it was, that demo we played was very Metroidvania, though. It was mostly Brawler.
Yeah, they, actually, I just got through playing in the final game, the section that we played in the demo.
Yeah.
And they had simplified it quite a bit.
Yeah.
And had removed there, although there was a part in there where we got a new ability, which was to wall jump.
Right.
And that lets you get to a place that you couldn't get to before. But it's linear in the sense that you're, at least so far, I have not had to like span all the way across the world map to go find things.
Because that's terrible game design.
Yeah, so that section that we played was within essentially a temple or a dungeon,
right,
that is like one major section of the game. So you go in there, you're gonna explore. There's a couple divergent paths you can go down. Eventually you will find a couple of abilities that let you get to the end, and then you will fight some kind of boss, or in this case, there's a chase sequence at the end that you and I died a lot on. It's actually a little bit easier with only one player.
I cleared it, to be fair. I did.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, Guacamelee is very much a Metroidvania kind of game, and it's pretty honest about that heritage. In fact, the statues that you get new abilities from are called Chuzo statues.
Yeah, we did notice that.
And they look almost identical to the ones in Super Metroid, although they're filtered through this game's weird kind of...
filter?
Vector art. So, yeah, vaguely, comically racist.
Yeah, a bit.
It was style.
Somebody was it the person in front of us who was wondering about what the line is between being satire and just being racist? I'm trying to remember.
I heard that the whole idea for the entire premise and theme of the game came from a member of the development studio who was from Mexico.
Oh, that's the oldest defense in the book.
No, some of my best friends are Mexicans. It's fine.
Now, how real is this? But supposedly, he had to like convince them that you know, this was a good idea, and he wanted, and it is, in a way, it is kind of a tribute to a lot of this weird esoteric, like, Mexican culture. It's set during the Day of the Dead.
Yeah, I mean, the art style is all very Dia de los Muertos stuff.
Yeah, that's, and that is very much the theme of it, and these skeletons are coming up out of some other dimension, and you play this this guy who's, I forget what his job is in the village, but anyway, he goes and to meet with El Presidente's daughter, and this demon shows up and kidnaps her and then sends you to the netherworld. And you basically just fall straight down. And in the netherworld, you find the statue with this luchador mask on it. And you take the mask and it transforms you into this luchador wrestling superhero. And then you fight your way back up to the village and go on this quest to save the president's daughter. And it's very tongue-in-cheek. I mean, it's definitely funny. There's also not really moments that have made me uncomfortable, but moments that made me think, I don't know if that's really tasteful or not. You know, like, I kind of recognize the cultural reference, but I don't really know if that's something that a Mexican person would find offensive.
Would they go like,
is it okay to laugh at this?
Yeah, well, it's not that. I mean, I don't care. But I think they do kind of walk a fine line of tastefulness on some of these references.
And even in the demo we saw, there were a couple where I'm like, really?
Yeah, and they also do this thing. There's a lot of billboards in the background that have references to other video games, which is something that they did in their previous game, Mutant Blobs Attack on Vita, which is a fantastic 2D platformer. I never got a chance to talk about it on the show. I'm not going to do it now, but if you have a Vita, it is absolutely a must play. It is one of the best games I've played on Vita so far. And I'm playing this on Vita as well, although when you buy it on PS3, you get both copies. And you can actually transfer your save over. And I think if you want to play two-player on the PS3, you can actually have the second player use the Vita as a controller, which is I don't know how useful that is. It's a cool idea.
Yeah.
But it's a kind of game that, I mean, James and I were having fun two-player, but considering it is very much, you know, you're trying to push forward through this adventure and explore this world and gain new powers, I don't know if it's really the kind of game I'd want to play in two-player. That's almost a distraction from the kind of progress that you're trying to make all the time. But it seemed to work well at PAX, at least. But yeah, this definitely has a fair bit of combat in it, which I know people oftentimes don't care for in their Metroidvania games. I'm not opposed to it. In fact, one of my favorite Metroidvanias was the Spider-Man, which one was it? The Web of Shadows game for DS. So. And that had quite a bit of combat in it, but to me it was fine because the combat was interesting and that it made really good use of Spider-Man's powers and it made good use of platforming also, and they were constantly kind of switching up the kinds of enemies and the combinations that they would throw at you. And this game, I feel, does very much the same thing. At least so far, I'm not getting sick of the combat because you have a few different moves. They're interesting to use. They let you throw enemies into each other, which sometimes can be very good defense. And they keep throwing different, you know, challenging combinations of enemies at me. They factor in all the new powers that I'm getting as I go along. So far I'm fine with it. But and they're not even necessarily kill rooms in this game. It's more just sometimes there will be areas where you're not really going to be able to do the platforming until you kill the enemies because they're going to disrupt you as you go. I've been a couple of bosses. Anyway, Guacamelee seems really fun. It has a very weird presentation for sure. I'm finding it really funny. And oh, I was going to say about the billboards. In this game, they also do a lot of video game references on the billboards, except they're all filtered through the whole Mexican theme. So there's even there's a billboard with like Mario and Luigi. Well, there's a couple of luchadors who are kind of dressed like Mario and Luigi. And you know, there's some name that it's like Plumber Brothers or something in Spanish.
There's like Mega Hombre.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's stuff like that. It's like, you don't have to know Spanish to play this game, but if you know at least like, let's say the 20 most common words, like if you can order, you know, if you can order off of a Mexican restaurant menu, you're going to get most of the jokes in this game. Like it's very rudimentary Spanish. But it helps a little bit, you know, if you just know the basic words. I think maybe it has a similar style like Casa de Mi Padre, that movie that came out last year. So if you're a big fan of that, you know, you should definitely check this out. But it plays really well so far, and I've enjoyed the exploration and the, you know, gaining new skills. You can earn money and buy upgrades to some of your powers, and it seems really fun. So I'm looking forward to playing more of it.
At PAX, I asked the developer if there was a chance that it would come to Wii U, and while he said, well, there is, a chance, but don't count on it, unfortunately.
Well, it's a Sony PubFun game, so it's going to have some period of exclusivity. It's not published by Sony, but they helped fund the development of it.
Right.
So it's going to be a Sony exclusive for probably at least a year.
Yeah, that's I was reading about that earlier today, actually, and yeah, like there's usually an exclusivity window of at least a year against XBLA, so I assume Wii U as well, and it's like it's negotiable if you want to publish on PC. Like they don't seem to mind as much if you also publish on Steam.
Right, because it's not a direct competitor as far as they're concerned.
Exactly. Yeah.
It kind of is, but...
But they don't view it that way.
Yeah, maybe they should. Lately, I'm playing a lot of games on Steam that I could be playing on Wii U or vice versa. There seems to be quite a bit of overlap.
I think that's fair, though, because, I mean, at least that lets the dev reach the biggest audience that they can, right? They're not locked into just one console, so, you know, they always have that kind of fallback, like maybe if the console audience, if they don't like it and they don't really buy a lot of copies of it, then at least they'll have the PC audience to fall back on. So I can see that being kind of like a bargaining
chip.
Right,
and when I say it's not a competitor, I mean they're not having, it's not going to help out one of their primary console rivals. And that's how they view it.
Exactly. Yeah.
But it's not a friend of an enemy. It could steal sales away from the Sony platform.
It could, but, you know.
Indeed, yes. Yeah, so that's going to wrap it up for our new business segment. We're going to take a break and come back with your listener mail and a special retroactive announcement.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we have a review for Need for Speed Most Wanted by Tyler Olu. Drive around a beautiful city like an asshole, and just like being an asshole, it turns out is a blast. So go and drive your car like a homicidal maniac and go get this game. We also have an interview with Yacht Club Games about Shovel Knight. We sit down with Sean Velasco of Yacht Club to discuss their 8-bit bell of the Kickstarter ball, Shovel Knight. Get his thoughts on making an old-school action platformer. About digging through bosses' faces.
All right, and we have a staff roundtable on Batman Arkham Origins. The staff offers their take on the newly announced Batman Arkham Origins. The Wii U game is a standard Batman affair, but the 3DS game is a 2.5D Metroidvania adventure from Armature Studios, former retro staffers who made a valiant attempt to kill Mega Man forever.
We have a feature where the staff picked their game of the month of March. And by acclamation, Luigi's Mansion Dark Moon won the hearts of the NWR staff. A few people picked Monster Hunter, but there's no help for them.
Guillaume actually picked Lego City, but justifies it.
This is our first ever game of the month.
I picked the game that I played in March, yes. That is what everyone did.
Pretty much. I mean, that's the problem with games of the month and games of the year in general.
I'm usually playing games from the month before. So.
Or earlier.
I'm usually unwrapping games from the month before.
From the year before.
if that.
We have a feature this week that we have a lot. Japan eShop Roundup by Danny Bivens. Oh god, Japan, what are you doing? Why are you putting videos about paternal dry cleaners on your eShop? You don't even know, do you? These figures. Get it together. We also have a feature, our very first review revisit, this time for Gunman Clive. The staff pulled up to talk some Gunman Clive in the form of bite-sized reviews, while most of the staff agreed with NWR's initial review that Gunman Clive was the best thing since sliced bread. I correctly let them know that their opinion was as flawed as the game. You're welcome.
I was afraid before James chimed in that I would be the outlier with
the
8 out of 10.
No! The best part is I expected to just get destroyed in the talkbacks. They're like, no, we agree. I'm like, oh. This sort of lets me down a little bit.
So you can go read all these great original articles over at Nintendo World Report. Welcome back, everyone. It's time for listener mail. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And Guillaume has the first email this week.
Sure. Chris writes, "We all want the Mother series localized and put on all our shiny new systems, right?"
No.
Shut up.
End email. Yes. Done. We're done.
Nintendo doesn't seem to think it's necessarily a safe bet that they'll make their money back on their investment, what with it being a relatively expensive endeavor. I'm thinking, why not give us the opportunity to pay for it up front? I'm confident that were Nintendo to let us know what it would cost them to bring the game stateside and create a Kickstarter event, there would be enough people out there to make their goal and then some. Wii U Virtual Console versions of all three Mother games sounds pretty swell to me. Do you guys think this could work?
It could work, but it will never happen.
It would never happen, and honestly, I don't think that it would work. I think the Mother fan base overestimates how many people actually give a shit about the Mother series.
Well, that's the thing about Kickstarter. You don't necessarily need a lot of people to pay. You just need a few people to pay a lot of money. And there are people who are so passionate about the series that hasn't had an American release in, what, almost 20 years now, that they would very gladly spend hundreds of dollars. And, you know, and I think you could take a relatively small base of people and raise any sum that you want. You name the amount and they will come up with it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it'll get viral and word will spread and, you know, people will jump in on it, especially at the lower tiers. And, you know, just to kind of pre-buy something or to get some neat little thing. That's the way Kickstarter works. And, you know, when they're successful, it's often funded by a very small number of people who are willing to put up far, far more than the game itself is really worth. But, you know, the problem here is just Nintendo's corporate pride is
very traditional company.
They would never involve Kickstarter.
I don't think any major player in the industry can do this without taking a real serious hit to their pride. I mean, remember when it came out, Capcom, which is not a major company. They are a company that produces a lot of games, but they are not that big. Capcom was going to finance the development of Mega Man Legends 3 by selling a demo. And remember how he thought, that is the dumbest idea ever. At least they were selling something right off the bat. Like, you could buy it. Mm. It was a thing you could buy. And we thought, wow, that's pretty lame. Like, they don't have enough money to finance their own game. Imagine if they went and said, we're going to make this game on Kickstarter. We'd be like, are you fucking kidding me? But because it's Nintendo, maybe, you know, it's like, we put the blinders on and we don't. But I guarantee you, Nintendo shareholders would think this is the dumbest thing you've ever done.
Well, and also the fact, too, I mean, there's no way you could ever pull that off since they have billions in the bank.
Yeah,
really.
I mean,
they don't need people to kick in money for these projects. They don't.
Yeah, I mean, Nintendo has so much money, it's kind of shameful as it is. So,
yes.
I just don't know that the appetite's there for this. I mean, they would have to, A, they'd have to say it's worth it, and then B, they'd have to say we're... Even if they finance all of the marginal costs and all of the translation costs and all of the work of having someone then take the localized text and reprogram these games and then convert them to virtual console releases and then release them in North America and I guess the UK and Canada and, you know, Australia and what have you. Okay, is it really worth the time? I mean,
See, that's the thing. I could see them doing it around something like, you know, it's been 25 years or whatever like that, and they come out with some sort of deluxe version of them that is, you know, very prestigious. Right. But it's not going to happen. It's not going to be just a normal game release.
Yeah, and I think the issue they have is even if it costs them nothing, it still costs them resources. I mean, they're not going to – I mean, they could – I guess they could hire people and then fire them as soon as it's done.
Yeah.
But – I mean,
it's called contracting, bro.
I'm aware. I've lived the life, but I don't know how much Nintendo does for contracting like that. I mean,
they don't use contractors very much.
Yeah,
they certainly do a lot less than most of the really big game publishers.
So,
you know, I mean, then, and even if you look within the Kickstarter culture, which is not something I'm an expert on, but I've backed a few Kickstarters. I backed Shovel Knight. Just for full disclosure, when I talk about it later, you know, I back Cloudberry Kingdom because I think those are really interesting games, and I kind of like the plan that they have for them. But they're made by very small companies, and
right.
Kickstarter is really designed for very small companies to get out that have a big idea but don't have the money to make it, and that's that. You know, they do have some guiding principles for that kind of thing, and you look at like the biggest companies that have done video game related Kickstarters. You've got, you know, Double Fine, which is a small developer.
Right.
But they've made, you know, multi-million dollar games, you know, that were financed by bigger publishers, of course. But they've done it before, and there was some pushback in the early days for Double Fine, even. And mm-hmm. and Double Fine's argument was, you know, look, we can make games. You know, we're not going out of business or anything. We don't need you to save us, but we want to make this very specific kind of game, this point-and-click yeah. adventure, and no publisher will ever pay for it.
Exactly.
And the only way it's ever going to get made is if we go through something like Kickstarter. And that story made sense, and they had a very good salesperson in Tim Schafer to tell that story and to convince people. There's been a lot of talk about, you know, what if some major publisher like EA or Activision or even like a medium-sized one like, let's say, Atlas, what if they go to Kickstarter and try to use that? And, you know, we don't really know how people would react to it. I mean, certainly they're entitled to do that, but especially if you're a publicly traded company like Nintendo, you have to wonder, like, what do their investors think about them going and sort of really kind of begging for money from their fans and saying, you know, give us the money now, we'll make the game later. And hopefully yeah. you'll like it. I don't know. If I'm a shareholder in Nintendo, I'm not a big fan of that model. It looks kind of desperate.
And if yeah. I'm one of the career guys at Nintendo, which if you're an executive, you're a career guy. You've been there a long time. I would feel pretty shitty if my company went and did that. I mean, I would feel like I've somehow diminished the company brand. Because Nintendo doesn't need to beg for your cash. They've got it. They already yeah. have your money.
Yep.
And frankly, surely there is a way for Nintendo to polish up these games, localize them, package them in such a way, you know, whether it's a combination of goodies that they pack in, new features that they add, or just a low price point and easy access through digital shops. But there's got to be a way for them to release these games in a way that's economical and profitable and that would please the fans. The problem is, I think there's a mindset at Nintendo, especially Nintendo of America, that people really kind of only care about the idea of the Mother series or the Earthbound series, and they don't actually care that much about the product. And I mean, you in their defense, the one time they've ever released a Mother series game over here in America, it was a total flop, and that was Earthbound on Super Nintendo.
Yep.
You know, and that game wasn't popular. I'm not even
and
sure
they tried.
It's popular
I mean,
now,
they really tried to push that game.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
They went to great lengths. They just put like scratch and sniff stickers in the package, and they gave you a strategy guide to make it more accessible. And it was a really nice package, a wonderful translation that they did on it. Is a really, you know, charming game. It's not like anything else on the system. And that game totally tanked.
It was also before RPGs exploded with Final Fantasy VII.
No, it wasn't. RPGs were deeply entrenched on the Super Nintendo as a console.
Well, yeah, sure, but they were still kind of, you know,
but
they were...
It failed relative to even some of the more niche Super Nintendo RPGs from companies like Capcom and in NX.
Yeah, but we've talked about like how Pokemon had changed the landscape for, you know, RPGs for Nintendo and, sure. you know, like in a post...
Yeah, but Pokemon's actually good.
Okay, I haven't played Earthbound, but anyway.
It's a hell of a game.
Am I the only one here who thinks that the fact that they've already announced that the GBA would be emulated on the Wii U kind of increases a lot the chances that we're going to see these games?
But they still have to translate it, and I just don't know that they feel it's worth
their
time. Well,
the translation's already done for, like, two of the games.
And they could certainly buy the rights to the third one. I mean, I don't know if they want to do that, but I think they could feasibly do that. And they could do that in such a way that, you know, I don't think they would lose a whole lot of face if they...
I think that their options are wide open these days. Like, after doing business with Exceed, you know, and letting them publish one of their games, and yeah. things like that, things that we would not have imagined 5 years ago.
But they were letting Exceed publish a game that they weren't in no way, shape, or form emotionally invested in.
Are you saying that they're emotionally invested in Mother?
I think they are. I mean, they've bothered to include characters from the franchise in every Smash Brothers game. I think they do care about this franchise.
Okay, but that's the Japanese side, though.
But
that's the Japanese
yeah.
side, and you know what? They are getting the ROM.
Like the North American side is his own company. They're still really freaking subservient. I mean, if Nintendo in Japan, in CL, said, hey, you're releasing Mother in the US, I'd be like, all right,
Yeah, sure, but I mean, like, the ROM is coming out, like, it is coming to the eShop in Japan, so...
Well, if they're going to... Well, first off, if they're going to release this game, they're not going to give you all three in one shot. You're paying for all of them individually.
Well, they did it on GBA in Japan.
Yeah, in GBA in Japan.
Well, no, it wasn't all three. It was Mother 1 plus 2 on one cartridge, and then Mother 3 was on a separate cartridge.
Right.
For GBA.
If they're going to go
through... could totally do that here, and they could localize those versions and release them on the eShop here. They have a lot of options. I mean, it comes down to, as we know, there are legal issues which we are skirting around. We're assuming that they can find a way to deal with that, whether it's, you know, changing the music or buying the rights or something. I don't know. And maybe that's all an urban legend, and maybe there's no legal problem at all, and that's just an excuse that people have come up with to rationalize why this series has disappeared completely from our shores. So I don't know. It's a very mysterious situation.
Yeah, I just don't think that we are, like, the situation has changed a lot since 5 years ago. I mean, you know, like, the game is coming out in Japan, so that's a first. Nintendo has collaborated with third parties to, but I don't even think that's a venue that they would take for Earthbound necessarily. But, you know, like, you can see that their approach has changed for a lot of things compared to the Wii.
Yeah.
And, I do think that, you know, like, can you think of a better way to invigorate the eShop and the Virtual Console and the Wii U than announcing that Earthbound is coming to it?
Yes, you know? Release like 47 other games came out.
Yeah, but I mean, like, the people who care about E3, though,
they'd get a lot of press, a lot of word of mouth. And Guillaume is right that the environment and the ecosystem in the West is totally different from when Earthbound was first released on Super Nintendo.
Yeah.
And not only have RPGs become a lot more mainstreamed, but these characters, you know, Ness and Lucas, have been now in three different Smash Brothers games and probably a fourth and a fifth one to come. So these characters are more well known, the levels that they, those stages that they take place in. So I think there is much more, a much wider familiarity with Earthbound, even among people who've never played one of those games.
Yeah.
So I think that it's, you know, the time has never been better to release Earthbound games.
I would disagree. The time would have been better when these games came out.
Well, that's the thing, right? Like, right now, you can also look at it from the standpoint of JRPGs as a genre has nosedived in terms of general interest, which is what Nintendo may be looking at it as. They're like, okay, well, we know these games have this little niche kind of audience that are going to probably buy 10 copies of it.
Well, Pokemon is still going strong, though.
But Pokemon is the outlier. You can't...
Yeah, but... John is right. That's why they didn't want to release Xenoblade. That's why they didn't want to release The Last Story.
Yeah,
right.
But what looks more like Pokemon than Earthbound?
Everything. Every single JRPG looks... Pokemon is the most approachable JRPG on the market.
Yeah, and also the fact that it just took off. It's like comparing Earthbound and Monster Hunter. You can't even compare them. I mean...
Okay, I've never played Earthbound, but I don't know. Like, I see, you know, the chibi graphics. I see the guy riding a bike in kind of realistic cities, sorta. I don't know. They look very similar to
You're not wrong. You're not wrong, Guillaume. I mean, there are presentational overlaps.
Yeah, but sure. Gameplay wise, they're not that approachable of a game.
Yeah.
I mean, they're.
I disagree with you, James. I mean, Earthbound is essentially a riff on Dragon Quest, just like Pokemon is a different kind of riff on Dragon Quest, but they don't play that differently.
But Pokemon is designed to be bought the shit out of, though. The goal of it is to collect all of these monsters, and then guess what? We're going to release another game, and then you have to collect all of them, and you can import all of your monsters from the game before it. I mean, the thing is, it's basically a fucking cash machine.
Yeah. It's a literal... I mean, it's in the literal mission statement of the game to make you buy shit.
Okay, I'm not the world's biggest Pokemon expert, but I think the messaging was not really, like, buy these two versions of the game. It was, like, share Pokemons with your friends.
Yes, it was convince your friends to buy this game also.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, the messaging was, unless you have access to both games, you will never be a Pokemon master. They didn't care how you got access to Blue. Just if you don't have it, you are fucking lame.
Yeah, the fact that they're selling two versions of effectively the same game
It's not like they didn't fit. They were already on the cartridge.
Exactly. Yeah, I talk about DLC already on the cartridge. There you fucking go. Pokemon started that shit.
Is it too late to make like a year prediction? Like, it's probably just wishful thinking.
It's never too late.
It's
yo,
never
please.
Too late. People love predictions.
It's probably wishful thinking on my part. But I think one of two things will happen at E3. You know, like they always like to release some game that's been eagerly awaited on their virtual console service while we're at E3. So I think it's the Wii U's turn, and I think either like Yoshi's Island or Earthbound are going
to
make it.
It won't be Yoshi's Island unless they're going to try to Yoshi up the entire press conference, because they're going to have Yoshi's Epic Yarn there.
Well, yeah, that would be a good opportunity.
I mean, unless they're going to just completely Yoshi it up on stage, at which point it'll be uncomfortable for everyone in the room.
I think they're going to hold those Zelda Oracle games for E3.
Hmm, okay, that's also... you just crushed my dreams. You're probably right.
You've been metzed.
Let's thank Chris for the very interesting email. It's a wonderful idea. I think if Mother... If Nintendo ever relinquished the rights to Mother back to the original creator, and then he had the freedom to do something with it, this could totally happen, or any number of things could happen. But the block here is Nintendo themselves, and their stance on Mother and bringing it to the West seems very stubborn. But I hope it will break down one day, and I surely hope Guillaume is correct in his prediction. So James is going to read the next email.
Yep. Steven from Oshawa writes, "There's been enough forum talk about what's the point of Wii Mini when there's no SD card slot and no online functionality, that it's made me wonder if people think that even today it would not be worth purchasing a Wii for its disc-based retail games alone. Between the Nintendo Selects games and the prices of used Wii games, it should be possible to say that one could be gaining a collection of Wii retail games at a comparable price to getting a collection of games from the Wii Shop channel. Now, if there was a hypothetical additional version of the Wii system, say Wii Tiny or Wii Teeny with eyes, because I hate Steven, that is priced the same and is otherwise similar as the Wii Mini, but does not have a disc drive and therefore could not play any retail games, and instead does have access to games available through the Wii Shop channel, would that make the hypothetical Wii Tiny a better Wii to purchase over the Wii Mini? In other words..." Oh my god. In other words...
Where am I?
I'm in some place I don't understand.
My nose is bleeding. What's going on?
In other words, was the Wii's real strength in the games done through the disc-based retail games or through the Wii Shop Channel's downloadable games? Oh my god.
Okay, that was complicated. Yeah. Yes, it comes down to if you had to choose between only playing disc games on your Wii or only playing download games on your Wii... At this point, not saying back in the early days, but now, knowing what we know now and having what's available now, which would you rather choose?
Is that the question?
Retail.
Because I think he was actually...
Basically. Mm. He could have cut the whole hypothetical out and just gone straight to the point. But instead, he dragged me through Wonderland of Nintendo console design.
I kind of wanted to make the point, though, that the Wii Mini does not just not have an SD card slot and online functionality. It's also... It doesn't have, like... It's not compatible with component cables. So it's not just the fact that, you know...
I didn't know that! That's awesome!
Yeah, it's just like, there's a warning in the manual after you've bought the thing that says, like, only compatible with the cable it came with.
Well, which is what? HDMI?
A composite? Composite, yeah. Anyway.
I mean, I guess if your TV has component jacks, you can put composite cables into that.
Wait, can you?
But...
I don't
think
you can. Really?
Okay.
Let me phrase it. I want to buy a Wii Mini right now. Just keep it sealed, put it in an acrylic case, and leave it in a closet somewhere.
All right. I'll ship one for you.
It's become clear that Wii Mini, I mean, it was released in Canada as kind of a test case, but I think the real purpose of it is to release it in places like Brazil and China and Korea. You know, places where consoles typically are not
in
released because they're too expensive. Yeah. So the idea here is that it's extremely simple to set up. You cannot pirate on it under any circumstances because there's no way to mod the data that's built into the system. Mm-hmm. And they can manufacture it for next to nothing. And so they can sell it for very low prices in these less wealthy
nations, very small,
and still make a profit on it. And it's tiny, it's cheap to ship, weighs nothing.
And you can fit in a very small apartment.
This is like an extreme, like, you know, tail end of generation moneymaker for them. They did not make this to sell it in, you know, America, Canada, England, France, Japan. These places that typically buy consoles at full price anyway. They made this for places where normally they might not release Wii at all.
Yeah.
And
places,
you know,
where
for,
there's
but...
barely internet, like Canada.
Yep. For rural countries like Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah.
that's how John escaped.
Like, I don't think that the conclusion that, oh, people don't think that the retail library is worth it is the conclusion that you should come to. It's really that the Wii Mini is not appealing for a number of factors for us who already have Wiis anyway.
It's not for you,
yeah,
man.
Right. Basically.
Yeah, that's what it comes down to. It's not
for
us.
So I don't think that you can then, you know, extrapolate from that, oh, well, perhaps the Wii is worth it then for its downloadable games. Because I, you know,
it's not.
As much as I like WiiWare, and I fucking love WiiWare. Like, there's a ton of great games on WiiWare. Mm-hmm. But
I agree.
I don't think it would really be worth it to buy a Wii just for WiiWare.
My library is heavily, heavily, heavily tilted towards retail games. But if you were going to ask me which functionality of the hardware I had to pick, it would be the retail ones.
Yeah.
So granted, I'm a little biased, but I mean they're much more substantial experiences, and there's a lot of them. I mean, but ultimately that's the point. This isn't about trying to make that decision. It's kind of a false dichotomy here. Really, this is just about releasing a console that nobody can get at. And if you have to make it look like a McDonald's Big Mac box from the 80s and ship it to China, great. Perfect. It'll work.
It looks cool. It looks cool.
It looks ridiculous.
But let's stick to the hypothetical here. This is not a...
Right.
We're not evaluating the viability of the Wii Mini or something.
Well, I mean, in a way, isn't that kind of the point of his question? I mean,
no, but you guys are discounting in the hypothetical Wii Tiny that only gets download games. You guys are discounting the presence of the virtual console. And I would say,
I'm not.
Someone who owns about 80 to 85 games that I downloaded to my Wii and had to transfer laboriously to my Wii U, I think download is the clear winner here.
Yeah, sure. I've got like 20 pages of stuff that I've had to download again on my Wii U. So I do lean heavily towards the download side as well. But you know, like again, like at this point, if Nintendo made a downloads only console, like it would be a slap in the face of all the WiiWare developers who suffered because of Nintendo's weird contracts and the fact that like a lot of these developers never got a dime for the games that they sold through WiiWare. You know, like Nintendo had this weird deal where if you had to sell a certain number of games, a certain number of copies before you would get a return on it. And so there's a ton of developers who did not, you know, reach the threshold. And yeah, like at this, and like they only had 2 years, I believe, to reach it, right?
That's all true. I don't know what it has to do with this argument.
Guillaume's getting into cosmic justice. I mean, this is the same reason he went and bought Tokyo Crash.
No, but I mean, like, if Nintendo were to really to push WiiWare at this point, after they're the only ones who are making money off other people's games, like how well would that go? With like,
no, I don't think they. I don't think they would take that into account in their decision.
No. Yeah, but they're trying. They're trying to court them with for the eShop for the Wii U though. Like, wouldn't that
but,
be shooting yourself in the foot? They already
those companies you're talking about no longer exist. Yeah, you know? They went bankrupt. So Nintendo is not trying to court those people to the eShop.
No, but there's still some of those developers are still around, and you know what? Like Max and the Magic Marker, not a great WiiWare game, not a terrible one either, but now they've been bought by Microsoft. They're making a sequel for Microsoft. You know, like, these people are still around. They're just not, you know, they don't want to touch Nintendo with a 10-foot pole.
Well, I think you should question Microsoft's wisdom in purchasing a developer who couldn't sell 3,000 copies of their WiiWare game.
I'm sure that game was successful enough, and it was ported to, like, Steam and, you know, PSN. But, I mean, in general, like, Nintendo didn't create themselves a good reputation with indie developers with the Wii. Like, would you disagree?
Sure.
So, and right now, I think they're trying to mend bridges. Like, they're trying to.
Yes.
Okay. So I think that at this point, you know, making a Wii Tiny or Teeny and just like profiting off these games and being the only ones profiting. And
it's a dick move.
It would be, yeah. And I don't think it would be doing them any favors.
It's not going to happen, so it doesn't really matter. But
right. Okay. Well, it's the question, though.
it would be douchey, and I had not considered that, so it's a good point.
But isn't it equally douchey what they did on the Wii U? And like, oh, you can still buy them here. I mean, it's really no different.
I think there is a difference between like a Wii built designed specifically to play download games and the presence of the Wii Shop on the Wii U.
Okay. John, what would your preference be?
Oh, I don't know. I stopped listening about 10 minutes ago.
All right. Let's move on to the next email.
Good call.
And, John is going to read this one.
All right. Okay. So let's see. Leon writes.
Was this so terrible, though?
What are the chances of Nintendo copying PS Plus, PlayStation Plus, with Nintendo Plus? PS Plus has already cost Nintendo 2 sales from me. I would have bought Trine for Wii U if I had not already got it for free from PS Plus. Then I was going to buy The Cave for Wii U, and then it came up for free on PS Plus. I've got enough stuff from PS Plus that I probably should stop buying games, but I don't have the self-control yet. Amen, that's brother.
That's our catered to
I
audience.
I wish Nintendo would do something similar so I could play the Wii U.
So basically what Leon's saying is, I wish Nintendo would willingly create a scenario where they basically give up lots of money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the PS Plus as a business proposition is the dumbest.
It's a loss leader.
Yeah, I mean, it is, but you have cases like Johnny where the only thing he bought from Sony was the fucking memory card. I mean, that's how messed up the PS Plus scenario is.
To be fair, I've bought a couple things on my Vita since
then.
I bought Persona 4 on sale, but on still. Sale.
Yeah.
And I bought a DLC for Sound Shapes that I haven't played yet, and I just bought Guacamelee, and I bought Dokoro because it was on sale for really cheap. So I've bought some things, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not a great economic proposition, PS Plus. I don't know how long Sony will be able to maintain it, to be honest. Because I mean,
yeah, I mean, I tell you right now, the way they're doing it now, the whole instant game library, forget that on PS4. No,
well,
fucking
yeah, you're,
way.
There's no yeah. way you're going to be paying more for that on PS4, guaranteed.
It's PlayStation Plus is going to do something entirely different on PS4.
Also, something to keep in mind with PS Plus is that it's cyclical. Like, I mean, there's a lot of games that came out for free on PS Plus that were on the Wii U that people didn't buy, perhaps. But all these games probably came out in June, because in June, that's where Sony likes to release like their 12, you know, instant collection games. And then it just dries up. There's like one game a month until perhaps like December. I'm not sure. In December, there's a lot of sales. There's fewer like free games. But then like it's just again one game a month until the next E3.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the PS Plus formula. I remember when PS Plus first came out and we were giving John such crap for signing up for it basically right away.
It was not a good deal.
It was awful. It was pretty awful at first, yeah.
We made so much fun of him, and then Sony went and just completely lost their minds. And they did. I mean, this is a completely insane business proposition. They are literally collecting, what, $50 from you at the start of the year, so they can turn around and easily pay developers of those games, the publishers of those games, cuts that more than eat away at that $50.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is, I really think that Sony wanted to... I think it was kind of a forward-looking move, because I think they wanted to have their online presence gain traction at any cost, especially ahead of the PS4's launch, right? So, I mean, Sony, as we know historically, Sony is not above, you know, losing money to try to gain, you know, traction. Blu-ray,
PS3. Losing billions of dollars.
Yeah, like they're not above that.
As James has noted, these digital games literally cost nothing to distribute. You know, you don't have to produce them. Once they're developed, they're out there, and you can make money on them forever. So
they're not all Sony games, though. They have to pay the publisher of those games. Mm-hmm.
They do, but my point is that the games that Sony's giving away for free are things that most people on PlayStation Plus either already bought or would not have bought if it wasn't free.
Such as yeah. Double Dragon Neon the first week it's released.
Okay, well that was a move of desperation by everybody involved.
Yeah, I don't think that Majesco had very high expectations for that game.
Well, yeah. To be fair, I didn't know Majesco was still around, so...
Yeah, me neither. yeah, occasionally they'll throw in something that seems like a ludicrously good deal, and I think that's just to kind of sweeten the pot and try to get more people to sign up. But
yeah,
a lot right. of the times they throw things out there like The Cave. If you didn't buy The Cave in the first month it was out, you're never going to buy it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's
agreed.
That's what it comes down to. And they're like, we've sold 95% of the sales we will ever get on this game on PSN. So sure, go ahead and give it away for free. You know, and the developer at Double Fine, they're going to get some tiny kickback, you know, from the number of copies that are downloaded or whatever. It's not very much, but it's more than zero. And for Sony, it's good because it convinces people they should stay subscribed. And the main thing, I think the main way that they do actually make money, and I think PlayStation Plus probably is ultimately profitable for Sony, because again, the things they're giving away cost them virtually nothing to give away. Mm-hmm. They're extremely appealing to people, but they don't really cost Sony anything, even much of an opportunity cost, because they're usually giving away things you would not have bought otherwise. But the way that they make money on it and probably break even or even make a profit on it is by selling you DLC and by selling you games at a discount that you might not have bought otherwise. So they'll give you great discounts on all these brand new downloadable games. Well, the reason they do that is because, you know, they want to convince you to buy the game online versus at retail. Or in cases of digital-only games, they want you to buy it like right away while people are still talking about it. You know, maybe you've never even played it before. You haven't even bothered to try the demo, but it's 20% off. So yeah, I'm just going to go buy it. And the idea is by giving you these discounts and making the whole shop infrastructure more appealing, they can get you to spend more money than you would have otherwise, even after the discounts. So this is basic retail economics. You know, I mean, people do this all the time at clothing stores, at car dealerships. It's not anything unusual. It's just we've never really seen it in the video game space before, especially from, you know, the first party platform holder. So that's the shocking thing about it.
Mm-hmm. I think the freebie games, though, on the Plus service are not long for this world.
Mm. I agree. The main reason they can do that is because PS3's been out for 6 years.
Well, and the reason they can do it on Vita is there's not that many of them out there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to be totally blunt, if Vita there were, you know, 20 million in U.S. hands and hot games are still coming out, they couldn't afford to do that.
Yeah.
So to them, it's a double loss leader at that point, because A, they're trying to get people to go out and buy the new hardware so they can get all this free shit that's out there, and B, trying to keep them engaged.
Mm-hmm.
And on the PS3, it's kind of a shrug your shoulders, whatever, this console's on its last, you know, year and a half or so anyway.
Well, I'll say this. PlayStation Plus has certainly got me spending a lot more time with my PS3 than I am with my Xbox. And it's a way for Sony to keep people engaged with their very old, aging platform until they get out the new one. So it's a way for them to build some continuity between the old generation and the new generation, which is something I think Nintendo could learn a lot from, except right now it's way too late. You know, they missed the boat there. But in terms of like Nintendo doing something similar to this for Wii U, I don't see it happening because they don't have this massive catalog of Wii U games that they can afford to shave off a few of the lesser known ones and give them away for quote unquote free just to entice you to spend more time with the thing. I mean, with PS3, there were literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of games that they had available to do this, and more still coming out. You'll notice there's still a lot of stuff coming out for PS3 on the digital side.
Yep.
And I think PlayStation Plus is very much a part of that. They've got people engaged with their store. I go every Tuesday night, I go to the PlayStation store to see what I can get for free from PlayStation Plus. And while I'm there, I might buy something else also. And that's a very valuable trick for them to play.
Just a pro tip, just checking the PlayStation blog loads much quicker than the PSN store.
That is true. But actually,
and they won't extort you out of any money.
Actually, PlayStation Plus has had a really weird effect on my gaming habits, because now I always want to be going on Tuesday and downloading whatever free game they've got. Even I may not play it for a long time. I've got a massive backlog at this point of like crazy stuff on PS3.
Mm-hmm.
But because I'm going to be going there and checking it anyway, Tuesday night has just become PlayStation night for me. And yeah. So usually I'll spend 2 or 3 hours playing Ni No Kuni because I'm still trying to burn through that game and I'm really enjoying it. But like, that's not a game you can play for 15 minutes. Like, you need a sizable chunk of time to sit down and play this huge JRPG. So Tuesday is the perfect night for me because I'll go to the store, I'll download something in the background, and then I'll turn on Ni No Kuni and I'll play it. And in the time that I play it, whatever I downloaded will finish. And I may or may not feel like playing it right away. I might just play Ni No Kuni until bedtime. But it's crazy now, because now I have this scheduled PlayStation night. And yeah. I don't have that for any other system.
Well, that's the thing. It gets kind of like Mindshare. But I mean, what you can also do is, you know, just download games to get them in your download history. Because once they're in your download history, and as long as you subscribe to PS Plus, you can download them at any time, whether they're free or not.
True. Yeah. So you don't have to download them right away.
You know, like, initially, I think PSN Plus had me doing the same thing, but I was already very engaged with the, like, the download services of every system I owned, including, like, DSiWare and WiiWare.
Oh, God!
You know, like, I was actually checking out the releases every week, so I was checking out the PSN releases every week. Sure. But at this point, I haven't... The last game I bought was Journey, because it was... There seemed to be no way that was coming to Instant Game Collection at this point. But before that, like, I must not have spent on PSN for like 6 months, whereas I was almost buying like a game a week before, or at least downloading a demo, a free demo, you know?
So Guillaume has gone and invoked the name of the download service that shall not be named. I think we need to move on.
Ultimately, what James said right from the very beginning is the truth. It's not really economically viable for Nintendo to do this. They're in a totally different situation than Sony is. And I think what you'll see when Sony launches their new system is that it's not going to make sense for them to do it either. And they'll still have the service, but it'll evolve into something different. But at the same time, the legacy service on PS3 will continue to be fantastic. Like, after PS4 comes out, as a PS3 owner, I'm sure PlayStation Plus will continue to be very lucrative because it's all profit from that point. I mean, they have nothing to lose at that point, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. Nintendo's early in their console cycle, so they've got everything to lose. You know, they can't sell a Wii U games to anybody right now. They definitely can't afford to give them away. Right. And they don't have enough stuff in their store to get that desperate to drive traffic to the store.
They don't have enough low-hanging fruit they can parcel out.
Yep. Maybe one day. I mean, maybe three or four years down the road, that might be a different story.
Yeah. Now this is where the whole third party acrimony really hurts them, because they don't have these third party games that they can just trot out there endlessly.
It's true. Yeah. All right. So the final email comes from Pete, and Pete writes, "I have three franchises that are potentially frighteningly expensive for me: mainline Tales of games, Dead or Alive, and Smash Brothers."
That is a weird triumvirate.
It is. DOA has forced me to pick up a Dreamcast and Xbox 360, a 3DS, and a PS Vita. No joke.
All those games.
I bought Tales of Graces months before I had a PS3. I bought Vesperia twice, and the disc still works. And I'd instantly jump in on a Namco crowdfund for any of the unreleased entries day one, no questions asked. Smash Bros. Brawl's original release date came within 2 months of my Wii purchase, and the Wii U update will definitely follow suit. Are there any franchises that completely break the spending logic of the hosts at RFN? Is there any 2-3 word combo preceded by a number or funny subtitle that you dread the release date of, knowing that the game's launch might as well be the system's in your eyes and wallet?
It's funny because right now I'm imagining his three titles put together in a perfect storm for him, and I'm just giggling to myself. I'm practically crying at the image. It's beautiful.
Actually, John is the perfect person to answer this question, since he's the only one of us who doesn't have a Wii U yet.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, if you're talking about Wii U, I mean, if they said, hey, we're going to have Metroid Prime 4, I'd be like, okay, I'll buy a Wii U with that game.
So that's the one.
That's the one, definitely. Absolutely.
Okay.
But that's not really breaking spending logic, because you're going to buy that system anyway.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's like if they were to say there's a new Ace Attorney game coming out, and it's going to be on the Amstrad CPC, so go find one. I'd be like, first off, fuck you, Capcom.
Yeah.
And secondly, God damn it, I have to go on eBay.
Well, I guess the best one right now would be the Neo Geo X Gold. which is a newish console that no one would ever buy normally.
Just as an aside, we saw someone at PAX with one.
Oh my god! Wow.
Actually, I saw quite a few of them at PAX East.
That's the terrifying part.
They were being sold on site.
Yeah. Ah, nice.
Oh my god.
It's tough for me. I mean, at this point, I own almost every system, and I expect that trend to continue. So it doesn't take a whole lot for me. I mean, I own a Vita, so it doesn't take that much for me to, break over that tipping point.
I own a PSP Go. Yeah. Nice. I win.
You
and
lost.
What was the driving force for you, Guillaume, on the PSP Go?
Oh, shit. That's a good question.
Sliding screens,
oh,
man.
Oh, actually, no, it was actually... I had been considering one for a while. So, like, there was, like, the whole catalog up to that point. But I think it was the release of the Lunar remake. Mm-hmm. Because I had heard so much good about Lunar. And I was just, oh, okay.
But why didn't you buy a regular PSP?
Well, because I wasn't counting on buying UMDs. And because I waited for a sale where a 16 gig PSP Go would cost me less than a PSP and a 16 gig memory stick.
Yeah.
We're going to call that sale the only time the PSP Go was rationally priced sale.
Yeah.
It's hard to argue with that.
Hey, yeah. I'm hard to argue with.
I wouldn't go that far. But yeah, I mean, there's a handful of games for me. I mean, like, it's Ace Attorney games. If they made another Ghost Trick game, I would have a child so I could sacrifice it to play it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there's it's kind of a weird, it's kind of like when somebody asks you what your favorite game is, you sit there and you go, I don't know. Let's think about it. Maybe there's a bunch of Capcom series in there that might fall on for me, which is bad because I hate that company right now. So
you love slash hate them.
Oh, I love slash really fucking hate them.
Like the thing is, like, if we're talking about killer apps, I get tired of series very quickly. So, you know, like what made me buy one console probably wasn't really worth it for the next console. I think it was Metroid Prime that convinced me to pick a GameCube over a PS2, which I was considering buying just for Jedi Starfighter of all games.
Oh my god!
Wow. It looked cool.
Did you ever get around to playing that game?
No, but I good. From what I understand, it's not very good. But you know, like, it kind of looked like a mix of Rogue Squadron and TIE Fighter because there were
it's
space
not.
Battles. Yeah, like that's what I figured
yeah,
out later.
That, I'm sure that's how they pitched it. In the meetings.
Right.
That's how they pitched it at E3.
But yeah, like Metroid Prime tipped me over, but I was interested enough in Eternal Darkness, and you know, I think the Wavebird and the larger memory card came out for the GameCube in the summer. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. like that pushed me to buy it, like to buy it before Metroid Prime came out. And then I think the Wii was like Metroid Prime 3, but then I played like 10 hours of the game and I didn't touch it for like 2 years.
Nice.
And the PS3, I actually bought for, and this was like, if you thought the decision to buy Jedi Starfighter was stupid, I bought a PS3 for Fallout 3.
I don't think that's too stupid.
But did you own anything else that could play it?
No, I didn't.
Okay. Like, if you said, oh, but I had a gaming PC, I'd be like,
no, but you know, like, it was like, I was debating, do I want the 360, do I want a PC? I think I was too poor for a PC at the time.
So you picked the most broken version.
Yeah, that's
the
what's kind of weird about that. It is the most broken version.
I didn't
of it.
Know that at the time. Yep. I didn't know that the PS3 was an impossible to develop for piece of crap.
Apparently for them, it is entirely impossible.
But also, like, always in the background, I had the idea that I wanted to play, like, Flower, and I wanted to play the PSN games that were out.
Mm-hmm. Also, Blu-rays, right? That was definitely a factor for me.
Not really. Not for me. I was over collecting DVDs, and I wasn't about to collect Blu-rays.
I'm quite thankful that a lot of the franchises for me that would be like a tipping point, I don't have to worry about anymore.
Final Fantasy, that's what's one for me that falls into that category.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, I was going to say Final Fantasy, you know, not nowadays.
Okay.
But back in,
right.
What, 97?
Yeah.
I bought a PlayStation to play Final Fantasy VII. I already had my N64. I mean, I was a Nintendo gamer. I was a pretty committed Nintendo fan at that point. But when they announced Final Fantasy VII coming to PlayStation 1, and I read in the EGM that preview with all the screenshots, and then I played the demo at my friend's house because they bought Tabal number 1, I said, well, I guess I'm buying a PlayStation. And I felt dirty about it. It's like, I don't want a PlayStation.
I was like, yep. I was like, I do not want this console, but I want to play Final Fantasy VII. So I'm like,
yeah.
Oh, God, all right, fine, I'll buy one. And I was perfectly happy. I love my 64. And I was just like, I just don't want to buy a Sony console.
Like, at the time, I thought this might be the only PlayStation game I ever buy. Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah, and that would be the only one you needed to buy. I mean, there's nothing else came out for that system. You're fine.
I bought Final Fantasy VIII and IX.
Yeah,
Chrono Cross, back when you didn't know it was not Chrono Trigger 2.
Yeah, I mean, I ended up buying several games, but it was a limited selection, you know. And I haven't bought that many PS3 games, but for PS3, it probably wasn't any single game. It was more there was enough of a back catalog at that point that I was curious about, and I definitely wanted a Blu-ray player. And when they released the slim model that had the lower price, I was like, okay.
Yep. I mean, like I said, I'm not in such bad straits because most of the series are Capcom series. Like, there's Breath of Fire and Mega Man X. Well, they're not going to release any of those games because they hate
them. No.
Mm-hmm. But like... Like, if Nintendo released another handheld, just for the sake of argument, and they said, oh, and we're going to put a Baten Kaitos game on it, and it's the only handheld that'll play it. Also, it's the only game that's going to come out for that handheld. I'd be like, fuck you, first off. Just fuck you so bad. How much is it? How much is a stupid handheld? Just take the money right now, but I'm pissed about it.
You love you some Baten Kaitos, don't you?
Oh, I do. It's so bad. It's like, I'm going to hold on. Like, I hate this. Like, I relatively hate the second game compared to the first game. I still played it like 4 times. like I love the first game so much. The second game just sort of, when you compare it, I'm like, eh. But at the same time, I'm like, I still love this game so much. they're like, Baten Kaitos 3 owned the Baten Kaitos handheld system.
We just learned something very special about James.
Does it come with the system? No, you have to buy them separately. Fuck.
I should get around to finishing Fallout 3 one of these days.
Can you finish it on the PS3 version? Is it even possible?
I played 30 hours of it, and then they patched it, and the saves were still compatible, but I was just, I don't feel it anymore.
They made this game better. I'm gonna stop playing it.
Well, like I don't know. I think I got they patched in like trophies, and so you had to start over to get trophies. And I think at the time I minded.
Yeah, no, that's one of those things stupid. Where you could just
fuck these trophies.
I could
see
that.
Did they patch in home support?
All right. Well, we've reached the DSiWare point of this email. So I'm gonna call an end to it. Thank you everyone for writing in. These were really fun questions this week. Lots of hypotheticals, actually.
Yeah.
But fun discussions to be had for sure. And as always, you can send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And before we go, I wanted to announce the next retroactive. Already, we just finished the last one last week.
Already in progress.
We're already announcing the new one. It's kind of a retroactive quick fire, and we got this idea from an email actually a couple weeks ago that asked us to try to settle the debate or at least
can I announce the games? It is
no.
It is Mega Hombre 2 versus Mega Hombre 3.
No.
That's right. So
we already have two languages on the show. That's enough of this.
So we talked about the epic duel between Mega Man 2 and 3 in listener mail, and now we're going to put it to the test. We're going to put it to the poll. We're going to ask you guys to go over to the forum thread and vote for which one you would like us to play, and by us, I mean all of us, you included, the listener, and we're going to do a retroactive pretty quickly here. You're going to have basically 10 days to vote from the time this episode comes out. So we'll give you one more reminder on the next episode. And then after that, we're going to announce the winner. And then after that, we're going to play it. So we'll have like 1 week to play the game. But they're Mega Man. I mean, they're not very long games, of course. So I think it's going to work out just fine. And it'll be a nice change of pace after, you know, the pretty fairly long trudge through Ys Book 1 and 2. And you know, Mega Man games are just pure action and they're classic, and these are both fantastic games. So no matter what you vote for, you can't go wrong here. We're all going to be very pleased no matter what the result is. But I thought, you know, it's actually a really interesting question. It's a fun debate that people have had for many, many years. Let's put it to the polls and just build it right into retroactive. So that's what we're going to do. And there'll be a link in the show notes for this episode. I hope you will go check it out and vote right now, because time is very limited.
Can I ask that you also add Mission Command?
No, you cannot! No,
you know, like, we're going to have a poll without an RPG.
No, no, that game game is balls.
We are going to have a poll without an RPG. That's correct. So it's Mega Man 2 versus Mega Man 3. There is no other. Go there and vote now, and we will play the winner. So that's all for this week. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll be back next time with Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye.
Later. Bye. And it's, in a way, like, you do end up switching a lot from costume to costume just to do, like, every single thing that's in your way. Like, there's a lot of, that can get a little bit tiring towards the end when you've got, like, 8 different costumes and you have to pick the right one to do this one thing. But where am I going with this? This is not the direction I wanted to go at all.
I asked you a question. You were
this is really a self-confident segment right here.
Yeah, inner monologue. Inner monologue.
Guillaume right here is just brimming with confidence at this moment.
Fuck. I had one last point.
You were going to talk about it being funny. I don't know. There we go. Done. Next up,
James. James is pure encouragement right now. This entire segment with Guillaume, he's just
been
patting him on the back.
I'm helping.
Tough love, James Jones. James, tough love Jones. That's what you are.
I'm helping.
All right.
And
so, you know, like, she has to deal with, you know, if you've got, like, the line of scenesters that twists in front of you, you have to attack just the part that is in front of you. I'm going to cut that out.
No, you're not. Stand in, or you're being disingenuous, and you're making everybody else look bad but yourself. Then you should feel bad. And since you're apparently susceptible to guilt, it stays in.
James Tough Love Jones, right, ladies and gentlemen.
Trot out like a whore.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go. Let's roll it.
Walk the Ave, honey.
Which Ave is that, John? I mean, you're back in Atlanta. Where would I go?
Hell, just walk out my door, pretty much. I'm not even really joking.
Guillaume, you have to work on the fine art of ignoring everything James says.
Oh, okay.
It's not a fine art.
Especially when he's commenting on what you just said.
It's not a fine art. It is a rejection of all things beautiful. If you want to live in a puritanical world, then by all means, enjoy your belt buckles on your hat. But
I don't even know what you're saying right now, James. I can't ignore it because it's so stupid. Belt buckles on hats. I don't even know what's going on. Again, my nose is bleeding.
But if you want to anticipate and appreciate real beauty, you should be focused on this, because this is where it's going to come from.
You mean on you?
On me. Yeah, this. I was pointing.
Now, at this point, I don't know if I'm going to edit the podcast so that, like, none of this gets out, or if I'm going to carefully optimize the number of supporters that I'm going to get against, like, evil James's trolling, you know?
It's not even trolling. It's just, like, opportunity comes up to say something. I say it.
I think that the caffeine really kicked in towards the last half hour there. That Red Bull and that, yeah, I don't know if you could tell.